Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, the Chase Down guys, Justin Rowan, Carter Rodriguez, join us to talk about all things Cleveland Cavaliers, the Big Four, who's the ideal fifth starter, changes to the team schematically. We talk about all that and more. Next, we talk about the Thunder beatdown of the Los Angeles Lakers, but more unfortunately, the injury to Luka Doncic. How will the Lakers persevere? What that means for award cases and checking in on some other candidates. And finally, ahead of the expansion draft happening later today, the Chicago Sky made a pair of trades to make sure that none of their players are going to be selected. Steve and I talk about our thoughts on the deal and some of the logic behind it. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve! Happy Friday. Happy expansion day. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce through your curveball. Weren't expecting that, were you?
Yeah, I was expecting the short intro since we have highly esteemed guests joining us on the pod. I appreciate the curveball, though. I swung and missed, but that's okay. Joining us on the show again, we have the crew from the Chase Down podcast, Justin Rowan, Carter Rodriguez. Welcome back to the show, fellas. How are y'all doing on this fine Friday?
I'm sleepy. Doing well, man. Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me. I'm going to talk right over you, Carter. Don't you dare. I speak first. We have a hierarchy for a reason. You know, we have a your turn, my turn dynamic going. This is not Donovan Mitchell and James Harden. We are not learning how to play with one another. I lead, you follow. How are you doing, Carter?
I was sleepy, but now I'm hurt.
We are off to a riveting start. Wow.
These West Coast trips, I'm not built for them anymore, you know? These 10 o'clock, 10:30 Eastern time tip on this this road trip. I don't got the juice, man. I got to get up with the children in the morning. So you got heavy eyes, Rodriguez, over here.
Listen, we're going to do the best that we can on the show. But as you are here, naturally, we are going to talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers today because they are a talented group. They are a fascinating group. At times, a confusing group, slightly injured group in terms of the depth. We're going to get there as well. But just to set the table for the Cavs right now, as of recording, 48-29 record. They're fourth in the Eastern Conference. One of the best home teams in the league. One of the best road teams in the league. Seventh in offense, 14th in defense, 10th in net rating per clean in the glass. And so just as a baseline question, I guess I'll start with you, Justin. You state the claim earlier in this podcast here. This is year two under Kenny Atkinson with the Cleveland Cavaliers. What changes have you kind of noticed from this year's team compared to last year's team? Does this feel like a different team schematically?
It definitely feels like a different team. I think they came out of last year's postseason trying to emulate some of the stuff that gave them trouble, right? Like, I think they came out of that Pacers series feeling like, hey, Indiana did a lot to get us uncomfortable on the offensive end of the floor, and we want to steal some of that, right? Like, we want to pick up a little higher. We want to pressure teams. We want to be more active. We want to get some deflections and change up our base scheme, because I think they did a really good job last year of staying back in their shell defensively, but they didn't really make teams feel uncomfortable. And even though they did not lose on the defensive end of the floor, like it was once again their offense not showing up in the postseason, I think they saw how their offense got impacted and said, hey, we could probably make our lives a little bit easier if we steal some of that. So I think it's been a feeling out process to see how much of that they can get away with their personnel. But it definitely feels like a different team for a variety of reasons. And some of that is scheme. Some of that is certainly availability.
Understood. Carter, I tossed the same question to you. Like, what feels different, or just how do you feel about the differences of this year's team compared to last year?
I'm with Justin. Like, you saw they were a pretty low, like, chaos stat team, and you know they're a top 10 deflections team now. So you're seeing them make some maybe getting a little riskier off ball. We saw them being a very much a shell team. Like, we're gonna switch everything. We're gonna stay in our shell. We're gonna trust that, especially when we're healthy, we're gonna have one of our bigs protecting the back line. So if you want to shoot over us, go ahead. And I do think, like, the personnel really did drive that early in the year. It's a guy like Lonzo Ball, rip in peace, creating chaos and going for those kind of deflections. Guys like Larry Nance were getting minutes early, big deflection guys. But then, even as those guys fell out of the rotation, they add Dennis Schroeder, Keon Ellis, and James Harden to the roster. And you know, Keon is absolutely going to be, you know, all over the place, making gambles, seeing what passing lanes he can jump. Schroeder the same way, and Harden, let's just say he'd rather you get by him and try to poke it out than try to, you know, always slide his feet every single time and be a super attentive point of attack defender. So like, I think at the end of the day, like, yeah, the defense does feel a little different. It's not been very good, I would say. I mean, they've been a bottom 10 defense, I think, post All-Star break. You know, I think that's mostly an availability and attention to detail issue. I don't think this team can't be a decent defense. And then offensively, it was kind of funny because we saw in the first half of the year, they're like, yeah, we're not a pick and roll team anymore. You know, and part of that was Darius being out, Ty Jerome getting replaced with Lonzo Ball. I thought to pretty mixed results, like they had a really hard time getting downhill and getting to the rim. And then they traded for James Harden and Dennis Schroeder. So they're a pick and roll team again. It feels like they've kind of flipped in a lot of ways back to a lot of what they were doing last year. Jerome has been worlds better than Schroeder, but like Harden is, you know, one of the best pick and roll players in the history of the sport. I think they are reaping the benefits of that change. And I think the offense has felt a little more dynamic, and, you know, not having Darius Garland to having James Harden is quite the change for an offense.
Well, something that was said, if you don't mind, Nikias, that stands out to me about the defense, right? I think that Cleveland has been known to have a certain level of defense. It's kind of shifted as they want to create more offense. And as the roster has changed, availability has changed. Do y'all believe this is a team that can scale up defensively? Have they tried enough things defensively to feel better about them in a playoff series? Because you do have Max Strus back. You do have the chaos of Dennis Schroeder and Keon Ellis coming in and changing the math. You have the versatility of Evan Mobley, the rim protection of Jaren Allen. Have they done enough to solve some playoff issues, or will this still be, we want to put Jared Allen, Donovan Mitchell, James Harden in action, and you have to figure that out?
I think this is going to be a worse version of the team defensively in the playoffs than we've seen in the past. And some of that is they made a shakeup at the trade deadline, right? You need chemistry and continuity, and you need to have that clear communication to play at a really, really high level on the defensive end of the floor. They just haven't had enough time together. Like, I think it would have been a tall order if everyone was available post All-Star break and they had the opportunity to work with one another. But when you have so many of those pieces missing time, right? Like Jared Allen misses a bunch of time. Dean Wade's out. Jalen Tyson's out. These are guys that are going to be prominently featured in the rotation if they are healthy. I just worry about the chemistry and continuity. And the other component of that is I just don't think they have as many good point of attack defenders. Like you look at kind of some of the tracking data and stuff like that. They had a lot more last season, right? Like Isaac Okoro would stay in front of his man, right? He didn't cause the same kind of event stats that Keon Ellis does, but he did a better job staying in front of his man than Keon Ellis. DeAndre Hunter can be a bit of an adventure off ball, but last year he did a better job on ball. Darius Garland last year rated out really well as a, you know, point of attack defender, staying in front of his man. Yes, they soft switched everything, so he had to, you know, he contested more shots from Jason Tatum than any player in the league last year, right? Like you have some stuff like that, and it did go well, but obviously that's physically taxing. And then Max Strus profiled as a very good point of attack defender. He doesn't have that same lateral quickness. You had Javonte Green that you could potentially go to, right? Like you had a whole variety of guys that could do that. This year, you don't have that same kind of defense at the point of attack. And I think they're making up for some of that by creating chaos. But it also feels like right now, this team doesn't necessarily trust one another when it comes to the point of attack defense. They're helping unnecessarily on some of those drives just because there's been so many blowbys, there's miscommunication. Some of that is getting used to one another. I think some of that is personnel.
I think a lot of it is also, you know, I joked about this on our last podcast that we were in a weird spot where the team is trying to find itself in the month that is generally the least correlative to actual success in the league. So it's like, are they over helping or are they not focused enough? Like, you know, is Donovan Mitchell, you know, off ball sliding in to help Evan Mobley because he doesn't trust the shell, or is he just not paying sharp enough attention to what's happening on the floor? And like, I do think there is a lot of that happening right now. And, you know, and it makes it really hard as people who watch this team on a night to night basis to know what's real and what's not. I do tend to agree with Justin that the defense has probably a lower floor than last year's team. I don't think they lost that series on defense, by the way. I think they lost it on offense. You know, they did. You look at the numbers; they did perfectly fine. You know, compared to everyone except OKC against Indy last year. But like at the end of the day, like I do think, like, you know, we're in a spot where we just kind of have to see it. Like, we haven't seen this team's defense fall apart because of the two guards, and the two guards are, I think, what scares us the most right now, that and health. You know, we are in a weird spot where while Darius certainly had real limitations, they were different limitations than Donovan, whereas like now you kind of have two of the same kind of guard in the backcourt, where it's the off-ball stuff's an adventure against the bigger, stronger guys. Donovan and James can both hold their own better than you'd think they'd be able to. But the, you know, the water bug, quick, jittery guys are really hard for them to handle. And I just don't quite know what to make of that, because so much of the stuff is that I'm seeing right now, and Kenny has been talking about it a lot in his post games, is like a lot of the stuff is effort and attention to detail stuff that you would presume would be better in the postseason. But you know, like, I also need to see them do it before I could just be like, I think the defense is going to be okay.
Understood. Steve, one question I want to toss your way, because this Cavs team is coming off of a 64-18 season. They're one of the best offenses of all time in terms of offensive rating. And they didn't have their season end the way that they wanted it to. And it certainly ended earlier than they wanted it to. And so for you, as someone that has been a part of teams and coaching staffs, how do you kind of balance, hey, this was really good, we need to maintain this, versus making some of these shifts in anticipation of what the next season can be? Like, how do you kind of find that middle ground between not shifting too much when you had success?
I think I kind of tie it back into what Justin mentioned earlier, where it's like, okay, we need to address some of the things that were brought up in the postseason, but you want to tweak without losing your identity. And I think for Cleveland, the toughest part, when I think about it, is the fact that they have had people in and out of the lineups, which has made it tougher to have the combination of this is our base plus this is what we're tweaking, because you've had to do different things at different times because you've had different people out there. And I think it's been interesting, especially post trade deadline. You add James Harden, who himself brings a different presence with the way the defenses will guard him, the way that he can attack switches, the attention that he'll get. You can get two on the ball, the playmaking he has. It opens something up, makes you a little bit different, right? But, okay, how many lineups can we get that in with? How does that look with double big? Does that combine with the big, big passing? How does that look like with three small guards out there and James Harden's technically the four? And we kind of find our rhythm within it. And that's where it gets interesting for me with Cleveland, because it's like, we know what they can do offensively. Cutting, spacing, pick and roll. They'll get downhill, they attack. Donovan Mitchell has been lights out. But now it's like, how many different combinations can we do it with? Which matchups can we win? And so from a coaching perspective, you don't want to take your team's identity away. You don't want to, you know, to over tweak to the point where you're not recognizable. You want to be the team that you are, but you still are learning who you are to a degree because you've added such a big piece. So it's a tough combination, because as Carter and Justin mentioned earlier, you were trying to do certain things earlier in the season. You've now gotten different personnel. We need to maximize Dennis Schroeder. We need to maximize Keon Ellis to a degree, spacing, driving. Jalen Tyson has shown different things. Sam Merrill does a little bit of everything. So he can screen, he can be off ball. How do we kind of blend all this together? So I think for me, it's just like, you don't want to change who you are, but you know you have to add to what you do.
Yeah, and I do think they've gotten to play with that. I do think they've gotten to play with that, but like the availability, and yeah, get wrecked, Justin. The availability has been really challenging in the back half of the year, just because, you know, like I am still seeing Kenny for extended stretches of the game playing, you know, like maybe we'll call him like half two lineups. Like it's not a lineup that maybe he's that interested, like that, like I think he would be that interested in playing, but he just has to because of who's available. You know, whether it's been, and now they're like down to two guys on the injury report, and they're still kind of pushed into some of those lineups because it's their only two big wing, you know, 3/4 type guys. So it's like, even when they don't have a laundry list of guys out right now, they're in this weird spot where it's like an entire position group out. And now it's, you know, and it's like these Craig Porter Jr., Dennis Schroeder, James Harden, Evan Mobley groups where it's like, well, is Evan not getting touches because they're not playing smart, or is it because no one's guarding Dennis or Craig Porter Jr.? Like, you know, those are the kind of the questions where like you just don't know. And like I'd love to ask you guys this, because like Justin and I are, you know, we try to contextualize everything over the course of a season. You know, we try to add, you know, we'll talk about shot variance, we'll talk about availability. But then we will try to talk about like, hey, what they can control. You know, we try to focus on the controllables. And I asked him on the pod, and I'm curious what you think. Are we just underrating how banged up they've been? Because if you look at the Spotrax games missed tracker, they have the second most missed games of any top eight team in either conference. They're at 259 going into last night. The only team more is OKC at 375. So I guess they're just going to never lose.
Shaker MVP.
But then Spotrac also tracks salary in games lost. So, okay, you know, like for example, OKC, they're going to have 82 missed games for Thomas Sorber. You know, that's not going to maybe tilt the scales. Cavs are second in that metric as well at $46 million in lost salary, you know, and I just would love to ask you guys, like, are, you know, for all the focus on attention to detail and point of attack defense and finding your identity, like, are we just being like, are we being like hardos that are like, just figure it out? And like, it's just, that might just be too much to deal with. I'm curious what you guys think.
I think that's part of my fascination with Cleveland, as you kind of mentioned, them not having a long injury list, but the guys that are out pretty much complete an entire position group. Like, no Dean Wade, no Jalen Tyson. Like, those are just guys that can play the four for you. Yeah. And when you want to get to these single big lineups, they can just be your fours in some of these alignments. And so I was watching Cavs Warriors last night, and we get later in the first quarter, and it is Dennis Schroeder, James Harden, Sam Merrill, Keon Ellis, and Thomas Bryant. I'm just like, I do not remember ever seeing this lineup play together. Immediately go to PvP stats. It has to be zero next to the bench. I was like, this does not seem like something that they would want to get to on purpose. I was like, why don't you go to a bigger four? And I was like, oh, right. They don't have Dean Wade right now. They don't have Jalen Tyson right now. Like, DeAndre Hunter just isn't there anymore, and it wasn't a great campaign for him this season anyway. I was like, oh, they just really don't have any options. So, like, I do think, in a sense, when you have so many lineup versatility questions with Cleveland in general, because I feel like throughout this era, it has been a lot of, is Mobley and Allen going to work? If it isn't, what does Mobley at the five look like? If Mobley doesn't do enough offensively, you feel better about some of the Jared Allen stuff. What does Jared Allen at the five with smaller guys look like? With that already tinting so much of the conversation for Cleveland, when you have a stretch, when you don't, you just do not have four options, or sometimes even three options, it's just like, well, I don't really know what to do with this. I don't like some of the drive containment. I don't like some of the defensive rebounding, because I remember how good they were last year, but they don't have size right now. And so, like, I give them grace, but then I look at the calendar. It's like, well, the playoffs are starting in a week and a half. I kind of have to evaluate what I'm looking at from talking about what their chances are to make a push. So, like, I've been kind of in a push and pull with it. I do think, to directly answer the question, yes, we've probably been a little too harsh within that regard, like, collectively. But we are just kind of reaching time where, yeah, you kind of have to figure it out because it's April.
Well, I think to add to that, it's easy to kind of look and be like, what is this? What are they doing? You're waiting for the everyone's healthy. We finally see what they are. And we just never have gotten that with Cleveland to a degree, especially post-trade. My analogy would be, you know, when you have the phone charger that is kind of frayed and broken at the bottom, and you can you still charge your phone, but you do have to put it in a certain position. You have to get the right angle, and then that that seeds into, you have to put something under the phone charger so that you can get to that same angle that you had, and then it elevates to, well, I have to elevate that. And I think that's been the Cleveland lineup structure to a degree, where it's just like, we can keep our phone charged, but we are going to have to figure out how to do that in an unideal setting. And hopefully in the playoffs, we can just buy a new charger and do what we want to do, live our lives in a different way.
Oh, man.
I am in awe.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and it gets back to something that I've been saying, right? Like, when you're trying to find an identity, when you have so many of these new pieces, I think you have to say, okay, what's here that was there before that we can kind of bank on? And I think for the Cavs, if they're going to have the success that they want to have in the postseason, it has to be the two bigs. I think that has to be kind of the foundation. We know that they work on both ends of the court. I think, you know, all those questions about the point of attack, they help clean that stuff up, right? And obviously you have some questions there. Jared Allen isn't going to be fully healthy for the remainder of the regular season. We'll see if he can get right by the playoffs with that knee tendonitis. But I think that that's going to have to be the identity that they lean in on. Because getting back to what you said, Steve, like, I think one of our issues with the Cavs over the last few years is when it comes to the postseason, when they lose, it doesn't feel like Cleveland Cavaliers basketball in that series, right? Like, I think there are teams that impose their style of play onto the opponent. When they lost to the Pacers, that felt like Pacers basketball. If I look back to, you know, the Orlando Magic losing to the Celtics last year, that felt like Orlando Magic basketball, right? Like, they dragged them down. I think part of why Boston lost that second round series was because they had to play Orlando in the first, right? Even though it only went five games, it felt like Magic basketball. And I think that's, you know, to Carter's point of, hey, are we not giving enough weight to the injuries and all that sort of thing? I feel like you needed to establish a new identity and then drill that down so that when things get tough, when you get pushed in a playoff setting, you're not reverting to old habits or confused about what you should be doing in that spot. And, you know, it's April. Like, you're going to have to figure something out. You're going to have to do something. These playoff series are going to be played. So for me, someone that believes that the regular season matters, right, when you're ironing out this kind of thing, that's where I get a lot of concern.
I think that is more than fair. I want to narrow down some of the conversation to get to some of these individual players. But first, as we've been talking a lot about some of the shifts that the Cavs have gone through this year compared to last year, defensively, we've mentioned the pickup points being higher for the Cleveland Cavaliers. They were 21st in how often they were picking up a ball handler in the backcourt last year. They have jumped to 13th this year. The average pickup distance, they were 20th last year. That has jumped up to 11th. They are not switching as often as they were in terms of pick and roll coverages. Like they were last year, they were third in switch rate. They're down to 10th, which is still pretty high, but again, a noticeable drop. They're putting two on the ball more in pick and roll. They were 27th last year, 16th this year. They're putting they're accounting two defenders to a player in general more often than they were last year. They've gone from 25th to 8th. So that activity has certainly perked up. One question that I did want to toss you guys away, I start with you, Carter. The activity for the Cleveland Cavaliers, like most of that conversation been towards the defensive end with the pickup points, with them blitzing more pick and rolls and things like that. It does feel like they've gotten a little bit more active on the ice this year. I think a lot of that has been wing driven with Jalen Tyson in particular when he's been in the rotation slash healthy. This also hasn't felt like the same transition defense for Cleveland to some of the attention to detail things. Do you think increased emphasis on offensive rebounding or just more guys being willing to go after those? Do you think that is impacting the transition defense in a real way? Or do you attribute that more to just general effort and attention to detail?
Oh, dude. I mean, $1 million question. I've had a hard time with this all year, trying to figure out what, you know, chicken or the egg. Because, yeah, the transition defense has been very, very poor. Yes, they are playing more guys who are more likely to crash the glass. You know, Jalen has been a revelation on that end. He's been really, really good in that spot. But honestly, dude, I think this is more of a focus problem if I had to really look at it. Because, like, yeah, for every Jalen Tyson crash, there's also just four guys underneath the free throw line watching the shot go up. You know, and, like, I think that is, like, that if I felt that if I felt a degree of chaos from the Cavs on the offensive glass, and it felt like it felt really intentional, maybe I'd be a little more okay with the transition defense stuff. But I do think there's just, especially earlier in the season, there is just a lot of that, like, you know, an overdrive or two guys in each corner instead of one guy lifting up to go back and transition. And, like, you know, like, there's a lot of those plays where it's like, hey, you're dead on arrival on some of these transition possessions. And I do think, like, you know, there is a middle ground here where you can send Jalen Tyson into crash because, you know, two to three guys are already on their way back. I'm not really seeing that level of connection from this team. And also, like, it was also, that's one of those funky things. And I'd love to ask Steve this, you know, with his coaching background of, like we talked about working on the thing, adding to your game, adding to your team's identity, knowing that you went out earlier than you wanted to. You saw some things that you didn't like, but, like, where do you kind of have to draw the line as a coach between, like, hey, we're not good enough on the offensive glass, but what if it's a talent issue? Because, like, I don't look at anyone on this team pretty much except Jalen Tyson and go, that's a great offensive rebounder. That's someone who is going, you know, they don't have the Josh Harts of the world that are going to consistently crash in and have 14, 15 rebound games. That's just really not who they are. So, like, if you are Coach Atkinson, like, where do you kind of lie now that you've played around all regular season with this? Is it like, all right, we have that in our bag, but let's go back to just getting back, like, when it's time? Because, like, it hasn't manifested in them being, like, a top 10 offensive rebounding team that is just, you know, decimating teams with second chance points. But, like, I don't disrespect the idea of sending a few guys in. What do you think?
I think it gets interesting because, one, the possession battle, no matter how annoyed I may get at the importance that it has, it is important to a degree. And there is value to just sending people to crash the glass. Now, the issue is you have to know, and this kind of ties into just overall coaching. Like, there are times where you see an action, you see a set, you see something that works, and then you have to realize, do we have the personnel to do that? We don't really. So we can take a portion of maybe that play or that spacing, but we can't necessarily replicate that. So I think when it comes to, like, a playoff game plan, you can very easily shift to, no matter what, if we get a shot up, everyone get back, we need to take away their transition offense. We need to make sure we're solid defensively, and becomes more of a focus point. And that's where I feel like the difference is between a regular season where this is what we do to a degree, and a playoff where it's like, we have to do this if we would like to win. And so I think it's easier to say, hey, everyone get back. This team pushes and we are not giving them easy points. Mm-hmm. And maybe we sacrifice some of the, hey, y'all have to box us out, you can't get out and run quicker, but we are going to sacrifice that because if we don't, we're going to give them easy runs. We're going to give them easy layups. We're going to give them easy points. And while we might not get what we want out of the possession battle, we're going to put ourselves in a better position to win the overall game. Would probably
and
be
I think that that's. Because... I didn't oh, no, mean to cut you off there.
You're
good, I was just going to say, I think that that is something that they're shifting towards as well, right? Like, since the All-Star break, the transition frequency is about the same. I think it's improved a little bit, but they're giving up fewer points per possession in those situations, right? They're now in the top 10 in points given up in those spots. The points per play is a whole lot better, right? So I think they're being a little more honest there, and they're not necessarily crashing the offensive glass as much.
They were 10th in offensive rebound rate pre-All-Star break. They're 15th post-All-Star break. That,
right. It definitely feels like there's a shift there, right? And I think the other component of this is, and why the transition defense is a little worse this season, is they're more turnover prone, right? Like, they've had more live ball turnovers this season. You know, going from Darius Garland, who for that usage and assist percentage, the only person with a better assist to turnover ratio in those healthy years is like Jokic, right? I think Brunson just edged him out last year as well. So he was third. But he's someone that took really good care of the basketball. James Harden is going to turn the ball over more. He's going to try more adventurous stuff, right? And large portions of the season where you weren't playing with Darius, right? And Craig Porter Jr. or Tyrese Proctor was forced to play or just kind of point guard by committee. So I think the increase of live ball turnovers is going to be part of that equation. And when you're in these ruts where the offense isn't clicking and things just aren't going your way, I think sometimes it's easy to let go of the rope. So I feel like they have had disaster games and games where it was perfectly fine and not a whole lot in between.
Let's talk about Donovan Mitchell, because I feel when we had you guys on the podcast last year, there was like not quite a debate, but there was a conversation around like, okay, who is the Cavs MVP candidate? Because Donovan Mitchell's kind of taking a step back, but he's filling in. Darius Garland's been super important. Evan Mobley's been super important, etc. This year, it's like we need Donovan Mitchell to be a superstar a lot more often than we needed him to be a superstar last season. And so, Justin, started with you. How have you felt like Donovan Mitchell has handled that responsibility and the way defenses have really loaded up against him this year?
I think offensively he's been fantastic this season, right? Like, and part of my argument last year for why Mitchell was still the MVP of the team was he took a step back at, you know, he chose leadership, right? He empowered Darius Garland, who was the leader of their offensive engine, right? Like, he was the one that when you look at the on-off stats, he had the most impact on the offensive end. And he helped empower Evan Mobley, right? He understood how important Mobley's development was for them to ultimately try to achieve their goals. This season, he's understood that he needs to do more, right? And I think his efficiency has been fantastic. I think what he's been doing on the offensive end has been really, really good. Now, the flip side of that is I do think that he is at his best when someone is being aggressive and initiating the offense. And I'm very interested in how that dynamic is going to work out, because I do think James Harden making Mitchell's life easier and utilizing the bigs the way that he's capable of doing, I think that that is the best way for this team to achieve its goals on the offensive end. Is that going to be the case, right? Like, I think it's difficult when you step into a situation as Harden is, where you have a guard that's playing at a level that warrants being in the MVP conversation, right? So I am interested to see what that dynamic's going to be. I think some of these recent games where things have fallen off the track a little bit have been, okay, teams are switching defensively. We're going a little bit too slow. So Mitchell's running into a brick wall and Harden's doing kind of his methodical thing. And it's just leading to step backs and we're not really getting the defense into rotation. I think for this team to achieve its goals on the offensive end of the floor, they need James Harden to be aggressive and making everybody's lives easier. And that includes Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah. I my thing with Donovan, obviously he was the only guy who could get to the rim for the first half of the year for this team. And, he really stepped up and also shot the cover off the ball and really kept them alive in a lot of games. It was, this team early on, when they were dealing with their health issues, they were dealing with some of their personnel changes, finding themselves. This is why you go get a Donovan Mitchell, because he can just raise your floor a little bit by being a guy who just get you 30 points on any given night. I think a big thing that I'm interested with the Harden pairing, because I think the James on the ball side of things is pretty cut and dry and makes a lot of sense right away. Because James is a great pick and roll player. He's a great passer, can find Donovan coming off pin downs and catching the ball to the advantage and helping Donovan get that very immediate, because like the thing is, Donovan can score on a set defense, but if he catches the ball on a not set defense, it's over, Like, it's just an immediate, he's going to get a great look 10 times out of 10. Mm-hmm. Something I'm really interested in is What does it look like when Donovan's on ball against a set defense and James is off ball? Because one thing about James that I find interesting, and I hate to do just the Darius comparisons over and over again, but you know, it's our best frame of reference, so I kind of feel like I have to keep going back to it. Darius, super active off ball player. He's flying around. He's setting screens. He's going off three pin downs and sprinting around from baseline to baseline. James is mostly going to stand there, and he will be guarded, so you will get to pretty much play 4-on-4. He's got some of the best gravity numbers in the league, but like, how can they get Donovan the ball with advantage a little bit more in those creation settings so he's not going up against a shell over and over and over again? Because it's just, I'm curious what you guys think, because like, I don't think James does a lot to like destabilize a defense. He will be guarded out there because he's such a great catch and shoot player, but he is not going to be, no one's going to be like, where's James going? Like off ball.
Now, very quickly, I think there's a trade-off, right? You could use Darius in so many actions and get him involved and have more of a flow and get some more movement. With James, it's going to be a little different because say you throw him the ball in a post-up scenario near the three-point line. You are now sacrificing about 3 or 4 seconds as he diagnoses what the defense is doing and the defense decides how much help are we going to show. You're giving that portion up, so you're going to be slower. But you have the scenario where they react, they send help, they show a double. You have like someone like Sam Merrill or Max Strus cutting, and you open up an advantage. You're trading off what you may have had as far as we've done multiple things to James Harden has 5 seconds to see what's happening. The defense reacts, we make a play. So I think that's an interesting dynamic, especially with how Cleveland is played, because you are going to open some things up to where James is going to make the defense think and make a decision. It may be slower 45% of the time, and it's not going to feel good when it doesn't.
If I can interrupt you though, to press a little bit on that, do you think like if the Darius Donovan partnership in terms of, you know, play initiation was 50-50 or 55-45, between the two guys, where it felt kind of even between who was initiating, do you think if you're in the James Harden business, he just needs to be the 70, it needs to be a 70-30 in those minutes those two are sharing, just to basically give him that time to diagnose? And then like Donovan might not initiate as much, but maybe he'll catch with advantage more often. Like, is that kind of the tree you're barking up? I'm curious.
I think it's probably at most 60-40. And I think that's only because of how Donovan has played this year, where, you know, we talked about Cleveland in flux. Donovan Mitchell, low-key, has just been the base as far as I'm going to make these plays every single night. Don't worry about it. And so when you have Donovan Mitchell playing at such a high level consistently, being able to get in the paint, be able to make whatever shot he wants to, putting pressure on teams when they go pick and roll and he's in drop, you can kind of lean more into James, set this up, let's see what you see. If you don't have anything, Donovan will do XYZ. As opposed to Donovan, you make this player read, and if we don't have it, we can get to James. Now, there is a different dynamic, I feel like, where if an initial set doesn't work out or break down, you can get James the ball. Now, you probably need to get it to him with like 13 on the clock as opposed to 7 on the clock. But, okay, we didn't get what we wanted. Now you have to defend James Harden in pick and roll or decides to ISO or post-up scenario. So I think there's a fluidity that Darius and Donovan Mitchell had that I don't know if James and Donovan will necessarily get to, but there's a pressure that James Harden and Donovan Mitchell can put on teams that I don't know that Darius and Donovan would have gotten to. And it's a odd dynamic to a degree.
And I think it gets back to what you said about being able to post up Harden, right? And I think he's better at getting a quality look and a scoring opportunity on a broken play than Darius is, right? I think sometimes he's even better at that than Donovan is, right? Just because he is longer, he is so physical, and that step back is so deadly, and he's more adept at getting to the free throw line, although not always the case in Cleveland. I've got my gripes about that. But I think you're right, right? Like, what I'm curious about is, you know, getting back to what Carter said, I do think that, you know, you have to kind of skew it a little bit more. So I Steve, I think you're right. 60-40 is the right amount. I'm just curious if it's 60-40 with the guard split, how much of it is going to be we're initiating through the bigs, right? Like we're having a dribble handoff. We're trying to get Evan Mobley involved, because I still think, like, as much as people talked about how many times have teams with a small backcourt won a championship, how many times have teams where their two best players are a point guard and shooting guard have won a championship, right? Like I think you always, for the sake of, you know, being able to diagnose playoff defenses, you always need to have that front court initiator. That always has to be part of the equation, right? Like, even if you want to argue Steph and Clay, they had Draymond, right, at power forward, right? The Raptors ran a lot of offense through Lowry and Van Vliet, but you had Kawhi, you had Marc Gasol as these kind of pressure release guys. So how it works when everybody is available, to me, is the biggest question. Because even when James came in and you saw how he was able to unlock Jared Allen, that came within the context of, hey, Evan Mobley's out and Donovan's missing some time. Jalen Tyson's great stretch this season was after Darius went, you know, had played his last game for the Cavs and was out for a while. Even this recent stretch where Harden and Mobley have such great chemistry, Jared Allen is out. Can you get on the same page and figure out what the hierarchy is going to be with those four guys when everyone's available and you've had so little time together?
That feels like the big question. I think just to zoom it out, your top four of Harden, Mitchell, Mobley, Allen, they've played 76 minutes. And this is a quartet that's been together essentially since early February. And you have under 100 minutes together. Now, they are plus 35 in those minutes. So they are like absolutely blitzing teams when they are together. But we haven't had that much time to see what that looks like on both ends of the floor. And to your overall point, just what exactly the hierarchy is going to look like. That's why I wanted to get the like touches per game number since the trade. I was like, okay, well, Harden is absolutely number one here. And then Mitchell, Mobley are kind of together. Then there's a drop from Allen, but even Jared Allen's getting more touches during this stretch than he was earlier this year compared to last season as well. And I think a lot of that is like some of the high post stuff.
Center in the league per minute, Nikias.
Oh, well, hey, listen, if he's going to continue to finish everything, you have to have some conversations about Jared Allen. But
let me tell you, the Jared Allen delegation has been thrilled with this this post All-Star break run.
Yeah, I'd imagine like 20 and 10, 72 or 73% on twos is something to smile about if you were a Cavs fan or a Jared Allen fan. But like, I do think that split is interesting. And even going back to how you kind of split up the guard touches between the two, like, I am with all of you. Like, I think James Harden is going to have to lead a lot of that. I was, as y'all were having that conversation, I was like, what do the relocation threes look like between these two? And I think it's 135 for Donovan Mitchell, it's 42 for James Harden. It's like, yeah, that was about right. In terms of not who's just getting spot up looks, but who is lifting from the corner to the wing, going from to the wing above the break, whatever. I think even bringing the Darius Garland comparison into it, like Donovan's probably your best version of that, or he's a better version of that than James Harden, to where if Harden is initiating going pick and roll, or if he's getting the ball at the elbow, or whatever, when that help comes, Donovan Mitchell is still a very willing mover all to where you can get those kind of catch and shoot looks, or he's just able to attack off the move. And through the context of what this season has been like for Donovan Mitchell in terms of what he is seeing, like seeing help on over 77% of his drops, like that's a huge jump from what it was last year per second spectrum. Any opportunity he has to dribble inside the three-point arc without seeing two bodies and four arms already there waiting for him, I think it's going to be a fruitful situation for him. So I'm curious to see like what that split is going to continue to look like. That's where these reps feel very important, and where like I have also felt turn your turn, this is even slower than you want it to be kind of possessions as of late, but they do just need the reps together. And I have a faith that it is going to look and feel better as we get to the postseason. At the very least, like those two guys have been largely durable since the Harden trade, but it's going to be track between those two. Let's go to the front court very quickly. I think aside from, hey, Donovan Mitchell has been awesome, is Darius Garland going to be healthy? And then he's eventually traded for James Harden. A lot of conversation, and rightfully so, around Evan Mobley and what this season has been. And like I recently wrote, as I did a big like all defense deep dive for Evan Mobley, in which he is on the short list for me at the very least. Ultimately didn't make my 10, but he's on the list. I kind of dropped the line. Like, I think people were so ready for him to go from an 87 to like a 93 that they are now just disappointed that he's an 87 when that is still a very good basketball player. And so I guess to start with you, Justin, like, how have you absorbed this Mobley season to where I feel like he has been good, just maybe not taking the leap that you want him to? Like, how do you kind of balance that disappointment with what he's actually doing on the floor?
First of all, I gotta ask, did you pull a reverse BAM with Mobley where it's like you didn't make the offensive leap, so I'm going to deduct you on the defensive end of the floor here? Because it feels a little bit like that. But no, I didn't love kind of, I thought there was an opportunity at the start of the year with no Darius Garland to let Mobley explore the space, right? And I thought Kenny experimenting in that way made some sense. I didn't love kind of how it was approached, though. It kind of felt sometimes like what they were trying to do is say, hey, go be Brandon Ingram, right? Like, we're going to kind of isolate you here on the perimeter or in, from the mid-range, and we're not really getting you the ball with advantage, but go self-create. And when it worked, it looked really good, and it was like, hey, this is something that we haven't necessarily seen before, but the rate at which it worked was not that encouraging, right? And I think you saw that in the team's overall offensive rating. They were 26th in offense, but before Darius got back to the lineup, and then all of a sudden Mobley was getting some of those easier touches. And I think recently on the offensive end, he's picking his spots better. I think that that is the biggest difference. I don't feel like there's necessarily been something that's been added to the bag, let's say. But I feel like he's doing a better job of recognizing when he has advantage and attacking it. I think he's been a whole lot more aggressive. I think he's also just healthier. You know, playing through that calf strain, it clearly had some impact on his explosiveness. And I think he looks more and more like himself. The Mobley of March has been last year's All-NBA Mobley in my eyes. Like, I think he had the one no-show game against Miami, but outside of that, I think the defense has been on point. I think his offensive production's been great. Been a bit of an adventure at the free throw line, but that's at least trending in the right direction the last couple games. But I think what they're getting from Evan Mobley lately has been what they've needed. My question is always going to be, do you get away from it in the clutch, right? Like, I thought there was a really, really important possession against Golden State there where Mobley was kind of, he got the ball late and he found Max Strus in the corner. Good things happen when you involve your bigs late and keep them involved. That has been the secret sauce for the Cavs. If I look back to that Lakers game where the Lakers are basically playing a strong side zone the entire game and Harden's probing and Mitchell's running into a brick wall, they abandoned the bigs too early. Mobley averages 34 front court touches per game. He got 15 in that game against the Lakers. Yeesh. What are you going to do with 15 touches for someone that not only can create for himself and finish at the rim at a high level, but can create those opportunities for a guy like Max Strus, right? So I think that gets back to what we're talking about of playing with purpose. Even if you're going to play a methodical style, you have to do everything else just that much sharper and that much quicker, whether it's, you know, slipping the screens, attacking. Like, you can't probe methodically and then execute methodically. You have to have some sharpness with that, and you have to keep these bigs involved.
I think for me, and I agreed with literally everything Justin said, so I'll take it to a slightly different angle, which is that I do think there was like a bit of a, I don't know, misunderstanding, and like, both from the basketball viewing public and like even like in how the Cavs were using him to start the year, at least as far as I'm concerned, and like what this Cavs team needs Evan Mobley to be in order to hit their ceiling. Like, I don't think they need him to be Giannis or like this guy that is initiating, like running, you know, 15 pick and rolls a game. They just need to be able to break that glass in case of emergency. Like, oh, they're putting two on the ball on the guards, or the guards are having a hard time getting into the offense because they're getting beat up, especially when it was Darius and Donovan, and you know the physicality really bothered them. I think Harden future proofs them against that quite a bit, just because you're not really going to speed up James Harden, but like or knock him off his balance. But like, I think what we needed to see is just like, hey, they're overcommitting to the guards. Evan, can you attack a destabilized defense consistently, you know, be decisive as a finisher, make, you know, make the reads to the corners for the easy wide open threes, And like, I think he has pivoted to that a lot more in the latter part of the season. He is finishing around the rim at a really, really high level. He shot 63% in the month of March, en route to 20 points a game in the month. And like, that's my thing. It's that. And then also just like to Justin's point, the touches and the involvement, it's not about being the lead initiator. It's about not being forgotten. He never crossed 13 field goal attempts in the postseason last year. Something we said at the end of that series, and this is like a great Justin line of like, I want to see Evan like have the right to go out on a shield, like to die a noble death and like get up 15, 16, 17, 20 shots and get a chance to attack over and over and over again. And we just really never saw that. So like, I felt like the Cavs were like early in the season, and some of this is availability. I don't think they would have done it if Darius was around and they still had Ty Jerome and all this other stuff. But like, I feel like they went from, they took the dial and turned it from 3 to 10. And I almost think it needs to go like 5.5, and that's probably enough. And if it's not enough, I think you actually probably have questions about your backcourt's ability to generate good offense.
Okay, that's fair. I think for me, real quick, I would just say early in the season, he was kind of having like the career year, but the shot diet was changing to a degree. There was a sandbox element to it. I think he was allowed to do different things and looking to do different things. And I think he's kind of evolved. And you kind of have to give a player an opportunity to do that. I think you need to be able to give them the freedom to do different things. And so run inverted pick and roll, get a post up, look to attack, look to drive. What you want from Evan Mobley is you just want no hesitancy as we get to the playoffs. Mm-hmm. You want to see him attack and look to get downhill.
Our boy is cursed with options.
Yeah. So, the easy button would be, hey, single big lineups, run pick and roll, have success. But because we've given you these reps, okay, let's see what you do. You can play with different dynamics. You can play with different lineups. And now, okay, do we get the payoff of, I understand when to drive, when to attack. The playmaking, I feel like, has gotten stronger as the season goes on. Obviously it's easy when he's like kind of the big, but like, hey, if James Harden gets a double and they're waiting on me and then someone rotates to me, I can find the open person. We can keep advantage basketball going. So I think for me with Evan Mobley, it's funny that Justin brought up Bam, because I feel like Bam kind of went through some of this where it's like, hey, why didn't you do more of XYZ? And it's like, well, I'm doing a lot of this. So like, I'm still doing a lot of basketball things, but you're waiting for me to do exactly tween hezzy, or I've now become someone you double. And like, success in basketball is not always linear. And so do we get the payoff? Do we feel better about the Evan Mobley that we see in the playoffs, where, okay, maybe he misses X amount of shots, but we got the looks we wanted. He was aggressive in those moments. He felt better overall. I think that's where you're preparing a player during the regular season for those moments.
I think that's a great way to put it, Steve. Like, that's what kind of popped for me with some of the early Mobley games and some of the early film, where it's like the efficiency isn't where you want it to be, but I'm looking at some of these drives and it's like, okay, he's creating like 4 or 5 more inches with these shoulder bumps than he was last year. Like, that feels important, even if he misses the short jump or the short push out. Like, that feels like that's going to be better. The passing ability has never really been in question for me. So, like, to Justin's point, like, what is the volume of front court touches and hub work he's going to get? Like, that's more of a Kenny question. But when he's asked to do so, like, I've never been like, ooh, is he going to be able to map out the floor? Is he going to be able to process that quickly? Is he going to be able to make that pass? Like, I've never really had those questions. The fact that Cleveland is allowing him, much like last year, we saw a jump there. But if he grabs the board, oh, you get to go. And then you can get some of these early screens. And, now we get an example of you attacking, but you're attacking a tilted defense already, which led me to one of my favorite stats as I was preparing for this pod. Of players that have run at least 200 pick and rolls this year, Evan Mobley, number one in points per possession generated this year. Very funny one.
Oh.
Yeah, so there you go.
Our inverted pick point, and like, roll king. Shout out Evan Mobley.
To that point, that's probably why you give these reps to what Steve was saying, because he has been, we saw him exploring the space early, and when he was running those pick and rolls with Sam Merrill screening or any of the other guards screening a lot of times early in the season, it was a kind of a try to string out. But because the jumper isn't that strong, they just hard hedge and the big man would get back. And what we've seen is he's just when he does just attack and force the guard who's hedging to just stay there, they're really able to make hay. They're able to either earn a switch, which is great because Evan is good enough, especially on small guards in the post, that he's going to get you a good look most of the time on that switch or draw a foul. They're able to just reset a little bit, but with, you know, a tilted defense without with a rim protector out guarding Sam Merrill 30 feet from the basket. So like, I guess like if you are someone who is like, hey, they pushed the Evan Mobley creation off button too much earlier in the year. Like that is, I think, some of the takeaways you've seen the comfort level rise. And now you don't see him let the defense off the hook with those hedges quite like he was earlier in the year.
No, but that's fair. Quickly to the other big in Jared Allen. As we've talked about him throughout this discussion, he has been insane since the All-Star break. Even more insane in March. Well, Carter, we'll start with you. What has impressed you the most about this Jared Allen stretch?
To me, this is just like the team and Jared Allen finally agreeing on what they need to do. I think Jared is such a mild-mannered, nice guy that there's been a degree of, like, it's just kind of easy to forget him. And it feels like he finally, you know, between himself, because this started before James got here, by the way. He had the 40 and 15 on 95% shooting against Portland before James got there. And it just feels like he kind of decided, like, well, I'm not going to allow myself to be forgotten anymore because, like, he's got, you know, 95th percentile type touch as a big man. Like, he can score with both hands. He's got floaters. He's able to get above the rim and finish. He's able to use the glass. He's got nice footwork. He's got better post footwork than Evan as a scorer. He doesn't have all the alien type of face-up creation that Evan has. But, like, as a back-to-the-basket player, like, he's a very good post scorer. And we've just seen him kind of commit to, if I touch the ball and I've got a switch, I must go up and score. I must go up and put an attempt up. And what we're seeing is what I've kind of always suspected, which is that if he does that, it'll work. I think it's become a self-perpetuating thing where the team is like, man, every time we throw it to Jarrett, even when the double comes, sometimes he's spinning through it and getting a bucket. He did that in that that otherwise horrific Lakers game where they were double teaming him and he was just scoring through them. I just think it's been and that's why I'm so disappointed about the knee tendonitis that took him out for 10 plus games and still has him on a minutes restriction. Because even since he's been back, even with a little bit of that pop taken away, like, hey, I've got the touch. And if I do my work and if I get deep seals, I'm just going to get buckets every time. And now I have a point guard who is never going to forget about me in James Harden. And I think that pairing and just the way the roster changed has made him more important. Like, you know, you could see this team dabbling. Sorry, I'm going to go really long on this because I love Jarrett so much. You could see the team dabbling early in the year with, like, what if we were Evan at the five team? You know, you'd see them closing with Dean Wade or DeAndre Hunter at the four. And I hated it every time because I'm just on team, like, the best teams are who they are and lean into the best parts of themselves if you want to win. And, like, that's always been, in my opinion, you know, the two guards and the two bigs taking care of each other, protecting each other, insulating from each other's weaknesses, adding redundancy. And, like, because they've gotten smaller everywhere else, I kind of think they're at the point now where, like, if you had asked me 3-4 months ago, like gun to your head, is Jared Allen going to be like a long part of this team's future? I'd be like, it doesn't seem like that's the message they're sending me. But now, because of the James addition, because of the way the roster has changed shape, it feels like they kind of can't function without him and Evan both on active and healthy at the same time. Like, they won't be themselves without them. Like, these guys are the identity of the team at this point, as far as I'm concerned.
I think quickly to your post-up point with Jared Allen, one of 54 players to log at least 50 in Second Spectrum's database. 1.2 points per possession on any trip featuring a Jared Allen post-up. That is seventh among that group. He's been doing the gosh darn thing. Want to sprinkle that in. Justin, for you, what has been the most impressive part of this Jared Allen run for you? And how do you think that kind of portends to this postseason run?
I'm going to say none of it's really impressing me because I knew that he's capable of doing this when he gets the touches. And I think sometimes Cavs fans can be guilty of object permanence, like not having it, because anytime someone is playing banged up, they just forget that they're good, right? And I think people overlook the fact that Jared Allen was playing with a fractured finger on his shooting hand to start the year. And then while dealing with that injury, had a sprain on the other hand. Like he had two bum hands. And when he can't necessarily squeeze the defensive rebound, it's like, oh, you know, he can't rebound. He missed a floater that he normally hits, you know, 9 out of 10 times. He can't do it. He's a bum. When Evan Mobley is dealing with a calf strain and he doesn't look at 100%, they forget how good he is. Jared Allen is capable of doing this if you reward him, right? And I think there have been times where I don't think there's a big man in the league that is going to give you 110% effort if they're not involved offensively. And I think back to that game two against the Pacers where Garland and Mobley were out, Allen was incredibly productive, but they went away from him in the second half largely. Donovan wore down. All of a sudden, they're turning the ball over a bunch. They give up that big lead. And that's one of those spots where I'm like, if we just kept feeding Jared Allen, if we just kind of allowed him to do his thing, we probably win that game. Or if, you know, free throw line violations were called, you win that game. But, you know, I think there are times where, you know, it comes down to the wire and you're just not involving Jared Allen at all offensively because you take what he brings to the table for granted and he gets a little checked out of the game and then all of a sudden he gets blamed for the loss. If you reward the bigs, good things will happen, right? If there's a reason for confidence in the Cavs being able to find another gear in the postseason, it's because Donovan Mitchell, James Harden, Evan Mobley, and Jared Allen fit. Like that just makes sense. We know that it worked with Darius. I think James is a brilliant playmaker. I think James, in fact, James is better at involving the bigs. I think he's a better fit for Evan Mobley and Jared Allen than he is with Donovan Mitchell, right? Like as much as this is a win now move on the Mitchell timeline, I think it does more to empower the bigs and keep them involved than it does opening up and freeing up Donovan Mitchell relative to the Garland pairing. So I think Harden is the absolute key here. It's why I think they need to continue to empower him and keep him aggressive, because I think that is the style of play that's going to lend itself to keeping Jared involved, keeping Evan involved, and keeping Mitchell's workload in a space where he can be as efficient as possible without wearing down. Carter's made such a great point before about how, you know, Mitchell has had these kitchen sink games in games 2 and 3 of some of these playoff series where I just, doesn't matter. I'm not letting us lose tonight. I'm putting up 45. It doesn't matter what you throw at me. I'm going to do this. If that game is coming in game 6, because Harden has helped manage the workload, you're probably going to have a better chance of winning that series. If that game has to occur in game 2 or 3, Donovan's going to wear down. We've seen it time and time again over his time in Cleveland where he's done these heroic performances, but I don't know if that Pacers series goes on much longer, if Donovan's even able to play. He wasn't able to finish the Celtics series, right? Like these calf strains and the soft tissue stuff pops up. We got to keep Mitchell's workload in a manageable position so that he can be his best when the team needs him to be his best.
I wanted to yes and a little bit on the Harden pairing with the bigs, because the one thing that I think is undervalued with both Evan and Jarrett is that their hands are so good. You know, Steve's very favorite Rudy Gobert, who can set the screens with the best of them, but can't always catch the pass thrown. You know, the cool thing about James is that because of the size, because of the genius, the passes he's able to throw are at these really weird and strange angles that are at, you know, that a big is not normally expecting to catch the ball at. Like, yes, he'll throw the pocket pass, but he'll also throw the weird lob to your back shoulder, like a, you know, like a back shoulder fade for a quarterback. That like a lot of bigs don't have the coordination. They don't have the feet or the hands to catch and then keep moving in stride on the way to the hoop. Both Evan and Jarrett have that level of coordination and the level of hands to turn those passes that a lot of bigs have to, you know, catch, but then gather, get their balance and then attack. They can go in stride on a lot of those passes. And I think that's why he's, you know, such an amazing fit with those guys and something that has materially changed the way they can contribute to this game.
I have one Jared Allen thing before Nikias goes rapid fire adjacent. I think for me, it's the aggression and the engagement, you know, just to kind of build on what Justin and Carter mentioned with Jared Allen. There's a different feel where, okay, you switch against me, I get a wing or someone, I'm going to seal and look to get a catch closer to the paint. Knowing that I'm going to get the ball, I'm more interested in this floater. I'm going to stay in your vision to get this pocket pass and kind of get this in-between game off so it's not always a hard roll or a lob. Like, no, give me the ball right here, and I'm not just automatically going to make a decision. I can shoot the ball. Elbow catch. You know what? I'd like to drive. Let's see what you want to do. Can you defend me? Let's like there's a mindset to where it's like, okay, if the lingering question is, hey, what is Cleveland going to do when teams switch? How many counters do we have? James Harden probably helps you out a little bit more. But if Jaren Allen's going to be willing to A, hit someone in the chest, and B, you know what? I'll drive against a big anyways. I think that adds layers to your offense. And so I think for me with Jared Allen, wanting to get the ball deeper in the post, being comfortable getting a catch, seeing the help. You know, we talked about a lot of Jalen Duren's growth last week, Nikias, but Jared Allen's kind of had that. Actually, I don't care if the help defense is here. This is not an automatic skip anymore. I would like to hit you in your chest and shoot a shot. And that's important for him and Cleveland, for him to be that level of aggressive and put pressure on teams, because you know the lob threat's there. You know he snakes very well around the basket. But if I add this little layer, okay, now I can make you pay and you don't feel good about your coverage.
I think, and I know Nikias probably wants to move us on, but you can't start a Jared Allen conversation and not have me talk about it. I think what Steve just mentioned there about that quick finish, that decision to go up even in sub-optimal circumstances, I think that really bodes well for the double big pairing in a postseason setting. Because that's one of the reasons, yes, the guards sometimes can break the offense and go do their own thing. But I think there's also that like, oh, that 3-foot gap is now a 1-foot gap. Or, hey, that help that took a second to get here, it's here earlier in the postseason. And I think sometimes the bigs can let perfect be the enemy of good. And like, if you're going to play 2 non-shooting bigs, like, and you're going to be navigating these tight spaces, sometimes that means going up with a shot in a tight space and trusting that you've got the touch and the skill and the footwork to get it up anyway. So I think like that stuff bodes really, really well for them if he's able to continue playing that way in a postseason setting.
So two things for me. One, I have enjoyed this Jared Allen conversation, so I'm really not in any rush to move forward. But the one thing that I did want to sprinkle in, as you were talking, as all of you kind of talk about the uptick in aggression for Jared Allen, mentioned the post-up stats. He logged 59 drives during the regular season last year per Second Spectrum. He's already at 89 this year on elite productivity on those drives. And so the fact that you can sprinkle that in with game, as you've already
mentioned. He played 82 last year.
Yeah. Yeah, so like he is just much more comfortable and much more intentional about, yeah, I can actually get downhill. And I think the seal point is also a good one, because he is very cliche or basic thing to say, but like Jared Allen is one of those bigs, if a shot is missing, he doesn't get the rebound, or even if he does, he gives it to his guard. He is going as fast as he can down the middle of the floor, even if he doesn't receive the ball. Like, that is a consistent thing with him and has been throughout his career. And so you mix in those rim runs and you get those passes, you can fly in for these what feels like 10-foot gathers. Like, he has some of the more underrated fast break dunks in the league among bigs, in my opinion. You have that, and then also, oh, there's a smaller person back here. I will just put you underneath the basket. You're going to have to foul me. And even if you do, I may make the shot anyway. Like, it's just been a very fun experience for me watching Jared Allen tap into this level of aggression. It's been a good time. Now, we've talked a lot about the big four. I did want to ask, as I always do, and what seems to be consistent with the Cleveland Cavaliers during this era, who is the fifth? We've gotten recent starts from Max Strus. Sam Merrill has started a bunch. Jalen Tyson, before his injury, he's also got some starts. And so I'll start with you, Carter. Who is the ideal fifth in the starting lineup with this group? Or if you want to zoom it out to what is their best lineup you can, but who's the ideal starter for this group?
So I think Kenny is going to go with Strus or Wade. Strus if he wants the shooting, Wade if he wants to press the defense and versatility button on that side of the floor. But I, you know, I was talking to Justin about this a couple weeks ago, and you know, I never thought I would ever say this, but given that Jalen has kind of had a dip post All-Star break, he was kind of who I wanted early. I wanted them just to stick with him. But you know, the team hasn't agreed, and Jalen's play hasn't really, I think, warranted it even before he got hurt. I think it's Sam Merrill, guys. He's just been better. He's just been better than these other role players over the life of the season. He has defended at a, you know, plus 80th percentile as an ISO defender, way better than last year. He's one of the only shooters I've ever heard in the offseason say, we had him at media day, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to work on my in-between stuff as a finisher and a mid-range shooter. And I'm not going to lie, guys. I was like, all right, brother, you know, because that's what you hear every shooter say every year. You know, that's not, that's like, you know, that's like 15 pounds of muscle, you know, but, yes. But he's done it. The 2-point volume is way up. The dribble drives, the assists are way up. He had a 10 rebound game the other day. You know, all the soft stuff is better. The jumper has been ridiculous. And I think that while I hated Sam at the three last year, because you were playing Darius Donovan and him, that's three guys, 6'4" or under. I think James being a bigger guard flips my math there. And I also think Sam is the guy I trust the most not to screw up on either end of the floor. And like, I just think they need that level of attention to detail. What a shot, by the way, on the live stream. What a picture of Sam there. but yeah, I just trust him not to make the mistakes. And then also, you know, the one of the downsides to James Harden is that the kind of the metronome offense, that everything is a little slower, everything's a little more, you know, it's predictable, but you can't stop it. I think Sam adds a little bit of chaos, the guard screens that defenses have to navigate before you get into the high pick and roll with the bigs. And then I just think if they're going to switch anyway, I don't really feel that bad about, you know, I don't feel like I'm getting that much of a difference from Dean being as a point of attack defender anyway. I think at the end of the day, like there are, I think I could find three better, like quote unquote fits from an archetype perspective. But if I'm Kenny, I'm just like, who's played the best? And like, at some point, who's played the best has to matter more than anything else. And I think Sam has played the best. So he would be my starter and my closer. Will he be? I don't think so. But that's what I would do.
Starter and closer. Like, you're getting bolder. All right. Ah, man, this is a tough question, and I was with Carter. I wanted Jalen Tyson to kind of be that guy, but before all the trades, I was thinking, you know, what if you do have, you know, Sam and Max coming in off the bench eventually, and back when they had DeAndre Hunter, I was like, you can have so much spacing for these one guard, one big pick and roll pairings, that would be so much fun. But the reality is, from an off-ball defense standpoint, Donovan Mitchell, James Harden, and Jalen Tyson is asking a lot. It did not work out particularly well. And Jalen Tyson's offensive numbers with those two haven't been great, right? So assuming he can get back, can get healthy, I want to make that assumption, but I have PTSD when it comes to toe injuries at this point. You know, giving him a higher usage, more ball handling reps with the second unit could be beneficial. His usage rate actually went up after the All-Star break, right? And some of that is early season where he wasn't as involved, but he's getting involved in the minutes that he has. So I think there's a benefit to bringing him in and off the bench. I think Carter makes a lot of good points when it comes to Sam Merrill, but I think what Sam's been able to do to improve as a playmaker, to work on his in-between game, you know, the finishing at the rim and stuff, it's helped him be a Max Simile, right? Where he does a lot of the stuff that Max Strus was bringing to the table last season. And
your most outrageous pun.
Thank you. I just feel like I would lean Max Strus. I like his connective playmaking, and his chemistry with Evan Mobley is insanely underrated. I am very concerned about his lateral quickness for coming back from that Jones fracture, right? Like, that's the one thing that hasn't necessarily been there. But you're probably most insulated when you're playing with the two bigs. You don't necessarily have to have him finish the game. I think he brings that same kind of chaos stuff to the table because he takes some ludicrous shots. He's a really good shot maker. You know, for anyone watching at home that's trying to, you know, improve as a player, but you don't necessarily have the sauce as an individual creator, watch Max Strus. Watch how he moves off ball. Watch what he does from a connective playmaking standpoint without having like some really advanced handle. I just love the way that this guy plays basketball. And there was a lineup last night against the Warriors where it was James Harden, Sam Merrill, Max Strus, and Jared Allen. That lineup rips. I want to see that either with Jalen Tyson or Dean Wade at the four. There is so much basketball IQ in that lineup and that configuration. Like, I want to see those guys together. I don't have a strong take on who should close. I think Dean is your best perimeter defender at this point. I think when you're playing the Boston Celtics and which is really the only team that's going to pressure you from a big wing creation standpoint, I think that's a Dean series. But I think at least starting off with Max Strus gives them a really good chance to start off on the right foot. And maybe you do go to Sam. Maybe you go to some of these other options, but the only true backup power forward on this roster is Dean. So if you're not going to be small when you're staggering, I think from a rotation standpoint, having Dean Wade play as the power forward in those single big lineups is the only configuration where you don't have four guys that are 6'5 or smaller out there.
Long-term storytelling, because we started out with this question being, hey, can Isaac Okoro make enough plays to make this work? And now we have optionality. Look at the growth. I think, to me, the best thing for Cleveland is the fact that they do have options and you feel good about all of them. And I think the consistency of Dean Wade and Sam Merrill, where if I'm Kenny Atkinson, I can trust what I'm going to get from Dean Wade on both ends of the floor. I know what Sam Merrill is going to provide. I'm trusting him to give the effort defensively, and he opens things up for us offensively. Jalen Tyson has shown what he can do, but I think he's kind of fallen into Kenny Atkinson's, I would like chaos. So if I can insert Dennis Schroeder, Keon Ellis, and Jalen Tyson into the game at the same time, let's see what that looks like. Let's get some stops and let's run. So I think Max Strus is one of the pieces where we can try and tap into the high ceiling what Max Strus brings to the table. And if he doesn't necessarily have it on this night, we know what we can pivot to. And I think that's kind of where you get some synergy lineup-wise, rotation-wise. I think for me, it's more so the strength for Cleveland, if you're looking at trying to make a deep playoff run, is it may be a Max series, it may be a Sam series, maybe a Tyson series. We may need all of them, but the fact that you can get to these different combinations, and I'm going to get all of you convert to James Harden at the four lineups at some point, I promise. But the fact that you at least have things in your back pocket is a positive for Cleveland. Now, part of the regular season is tinkering and experimenting and trying to figure out what this looks like. Do we have enough confidence that they know exactly what it looks like against certain teams? That will be answered in the playoffs. But at the very least, you know, we can try different things as opposed to, well, this didn't work. What are we going to do?
But Steve,
hang on, Carter. I got to add this before, because I'm a very forgetful boy. The one thing Max brings that nobody else brings to the table is he's going to yell at everybody out there. And I think that's really, really important. That guy is a communicator. That guy, you know, is going to raise the intensity level when it comes to the guards. Like, James Harden brings a lot more communication to the table than Darius Garland. He's a coach out there, but Max is going to absolutely rip into guys. And I think that that's important. I think that was part of the secret sauce when the Cavs won the championship, is for all the top end talent they had, Tristan Thompson was the one guy that was willing to yell at LeBron on the court when he was not paying attention. I think Max brings some of that to the table.
I did just want to call out one of my favorite Dunker Spot tropes, which is Dunker Spot boys ask guests a question ask us to give an answer and then fail to give an answer themselves. Because I heard Steve talk a lot about optionality. I didn't hear him make a pick.
Sure didn't.
See, thank you.
Well,
go ahead, give us one. We got a Struess, we got a Barrel.
Steve.
Me?
Yes!
I said Max Struess.
I said Max Struess. You didn't say Max Struess.
I did. I snuck it in there.
That is true. That is true. Again, I'm a forgetful boy, but Steve did say that. Steve did say that.
Okay, so we got two for you. All right, we got two for Struess. We got one for Merrill. My heart says Jalen Tyson because when healthy, like he has just shot leather off the offensive rebounding is pop. He could take on tough assignments defensively, even though I agree the off-ball can be an adventure. My head says Dean Wade because like I just want to raise the defensive ceiling as much as I can once we get into the postseason. And if you have any kind of concerns about what Mitchell plus Harden can look like, Dean Wade allows you to cross-match in a way that those other guys do not. And you can empower the switching a little bit more. Like Steve and I did a breakdown on the Cavs Knicks game where Dean Wade's on Jalen Brunson and they just wrecked their half court offense for most of that basketball game. And I think the Knicks could have did some things better, but like structurally, I was like, I what I am seeing here and I like what this unlocks. And even to the substitution portion, you two obviously have a better handle on what the actual substitution patterns are for Cleveland. But I think you can work around to Dean Wade starts. Maybe he's an early sub. You get in Merrill or Struess. And then as you downsize, you bring Wade back in as your backup force. You kind of get to those single big lineups that way. I think I lean Dean Wade in this case. Like, give me the size. Give me the defense. Give me the cross-matching. And he's shooting 39% from three as a starter, if we care about that. That has to sustain because teams, I think, are still going to be comfortable helping off of him. But if he can knock down enough shots, like he's also been part of the cutting and the offensive rebounding in that wing slash forward group, kind of my guy with these four.
I get it. But I would say you are trending back into the Isaac Okoro territory of, are you going to pass up open shots, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think that is going to be the key for Dean is when that ball swings to you, if you're open, you have to take it. If you're somewhat open, you have to take it. We mm-hmm. cannot have a record scratch here, particularly understanding that you are going to play a little slower and a little more methodical in the half court. If James just diagnosed the hell out of the defense for 8 seconds and got you a look, that shot has to go up. Taking it matters more to me than whether or not he's making it.
I think that is more than fair. Final question for me, for the two of you. Where can the people find you? Where can the people find your work?
You guys know where to find podcasts. Where did you find this one? If you found this podcast, you can find the Chase Down podcast. If it's in audio form, go to that same place. That's where you'll find the Chase Down. If you're watching on YouTube, go to the Cavs YouTube channel. Carter does a great job producing us there. We go live twice a week on the Cavs YouTube channel, so you can find us there. But come on, people. You know where to find us.
That may be my favorite guest outro that we've ever had on this podcast. Justin, thank you for that. Justin and Carter, thank you for your Cavs expertise. We appreciate y'all rocking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we are back with this episode of Dunker Spot. Again, thank you to the Chase Down guys for joining us for Cavs Talk. Now, just some quick news nuggets to close out the show. Most pressing on the NBA side, we had a premier matchup between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Los Angeles Lakers, which very quickly became an Oklahoma City blowout. NBA, we got Luka, we got Shea, and Lou Dort says, actually, you got me. Here's 14 first quarter points, all the threes, all the defense. Game got out of hand quickly. What made it more sad was the second half in which Luka Doncic grabs at the hamstring, goes out, doesn't return. He may be out a while. He may be out a week. But he is going to be out for the Los Angeles Lakers in the short term. So first and foremost, get well soon, Luka Doncic. Injuries overall stink. Injuries to superstars stink. And as we are a week and a half away from the playoffs, could not think of a worse time for a hamstring injury in particular to happen to someone that is as good and as important as Luka Doncic is. So just well wishes on that front. So the question I have for you, Steve, is in general, how do you see the Lakers kind of pushing through the stretch without Mitchell to go have an MRI today, so we'll find out hopefully today or tomorrow if it's going to be like he's out for a week and be reevaluated, or 2 weeks or whatever. How do you see the Lakers kind of shifting without Luka Doncic?
I mean, I don't know if it's shifting as much as managing. I mean, you have to go on and go forward, and so you're going to ask Austin Reaves to do more things. Probably going to ask LeBron to be more of a hub. You're going to have to get some more movement. You don't necessarily have the concrete base that Luka provided with the high level play he had, and so a bad night just kind of kept getting worse and worse if you're the Lakers, because you know this looked like it would be okay. Of the four teams, Lakers, Rockets, Wolves, Nuggets, you felt probably the best about the Lakers based on what they had done performance-wise, based on some of the tests they had passed. And so let's see how good we are against this team. It didn't go well. It kept not going well, and it continued to not go well, and then you lose Luka. So, you know, sometimes in April you have these reminders, okay, while we have made so much progress, we can't afford this without Luka. Okay, we're going to really have to lean into defense. We're going to really have to find a way to create plays. We're going to have some different lineups. But it was just a tough deal in the sense that, well, they've taken us out of everything. They're switching against us. They're helping off certain play people. They're poking at our zone. And so that dealing with the dynamic of OKC sending that message and losing Luka Doncic for an extended period of time, in the Western Conference, which is unforgiving, because, okay, yeah, you got 3 seed, maybe you fall. Maybe you get a different matchup. Maybe now you have to face OKC in the second round. Maybe you get a first-round opponent that's looking to attack you. It gets interesting. So I don't think there's an easy answer here. You just got to hope for the best for Luka. And if you're the Lakers, you got to lean into some of the habits you've tried to prevent. But, like, a lot of time left. I know we're close to the end of the season, but that 3, 4, 5, 6 is still pretty packed. So yeah. What do you do?
Yeah, to that point, Steve, 3 through 6, which as of recording is the Lakers at 3, the Nuggets at 4, the Rockets at 5, and the Wolves at 6. Only 3.5 games separate 3 to 6 right now. The Lakers only a game ahead of the Denver Nuggets right now. So, like, if there is any sort of legitimate slide, you could go from we're in a different bracket to we are no longer hosting series in the postseason. Now, there are a lot of veterans on this team. If you get Luka Doncic back, like, I don't think he's going to be scared to play on the road anywhere. In fact, he's probably going to relish the opportunity to rip the souls out of an opposing fan base on the road. But that kind of thing can matter. And for Luka, who is coming off of a March where he averaged 37.5 points, 8 boards, 7 assists on 63% shooting, like, just had one of the most ridiculous months that we have seen from a player ever. For the Thunder to just shut him down pre-injury was incredibly impressive from a Thunder defense that has been elite all year long. Like, what was it, 6 or 7 turnovers in that first quarter alone from the Lakers? Luka ends up with 6 in that game. It just thinks that it was that plus the injury part, to your point there. So not going to hang there too long. But quickly on the numbers front for the Los Angeles Lakers, they are 7-6 in games that Luka Doncic has not appeared in. A minus 2.3 net rating in over 1,400 minutes without Luka on the floor. So that accounts for when he goes to the bench and the games that he's missed. But when you have LeBron and Luka on the floor together without LeBron and Austin Reaves on the floor without Luka, a minus 4.7 net rating in 331 minutes. With LeBron on the floor without Reaves and obviously no Luka, it's a plus 8.2 in 408 minutes. So you get LeBron plus some shooters around him. He can steal headline those lineups. The Lakers naturally going to have to lead into some more of those lineups. And Austin Reaves on the floor without Luka and LeBron, a plus 0.7 net rating in 338 minutes. You want that to be higher, but they are slightly positive in those minutes. You're naturally going to see a good bit of that as well. So we'll see how they are able to push through as the regular season is nearing its close. And, like, naturally on the awards front, Luka Doncic is right at 64 games. If it is a minor injury for Luka Doncic, and let's say he misses a week, if he's back next Friday, the Lakers have the Phoenix Suns next Friday, and then they end the regular season against the Utah Jazz next Sunday when everybody plays. If he can play in one of those two games and appear in 20 or more minutes, he would hit 65 games. He'd be award eligible, in which case he's going to be on an MVP ballot. He's going to be on the All-NBA first team more than likely if he gets there. So we're on award watch on that front. But more importantly, get well soon, Luka, and for the Lakers playoff hopes. That is a bit unfortunate. Go ahead, Steve.
Award watch. So you mean to tell me everyone did all this Luka MVP yelling and screaming and back and forth, and he's not even going to be eligible for the award. And to be eligible for the award, he has to come back and play a certain amount of minutes. It feels like this is not the point of what people wanted with the 65 minimum. I don't know how anyone could feel comfortable having said that they want that.
I see. As someone that certainly did not mind the games played minimum, this is an unfortunate byproduct of having that hard line of 65. And so, again, we'll hope for...
What do you mean? Wonder who brought this up. Weird. Everyone ineligible.
Well, I wouldn't say everyone. We still have a pretty deep class, but that would be unfortunate for Luka Doncic. On that note, while we're talking about ineligibility, Cunningham, who is still out with a collapsed lung, slated to be reevaluated in a week, he is officially going to be ineligible for awards. He's going to fall under that 65-game threshold. Anthony Edwards, who missed last night's game against the Detroit Pistons with an illness, he's also dealing with a right knee thing. That officially is going to dip him underneath the 65 games played minimum. He can, in a literal sense, get up to 65 games, but third game of the year plays against the Indiana Pacers. He gets hurt. He only played in 3 minutes in that game and then missed the next four. But because he played 3 minutes, that is not a game that counts towards the total, since you have to play in at least 20 minutes for a game to be eligible or towards the eligibility mark. So Ant also going to be ineligible. Marcus Smart, who also missed the Lakers game and has been out for a little bit now with an ankle injury. He was someone that I mentioned with our all defense episode last week. With his absence, he is also going to be ineligible. So no all defense selection in his future as well. And if you want a few guys to keep an eye on as we get towards the end of the regular season, Victor Wembanyama needs to play in four of the next five games for the Spurs to be eligible. Did not play against the Clippers last night, so keep an eye on Wemby. Nikola Jokic has to also play four of his next five games. Kawhi Leonard also needs to appear in four of his next five games. Asar Thompson, someone I've been super high on the all-defense front, would be a first-teamer for me if he is eligible. He needs to appear in four of his next five games. He has played in 68 total games, but multiple games under that 20-minute or even under the 15-minute threshold. So we're going to keep an eye on him for all-defense. Nemeas Keita, same thing. He's played 71 total games, but only 63 are eligible right now. Stephon Castle has to play in one more game. So there are some other guys there, but wanted to get some of the headliners for MVP, All-NBA, All-Defense, etc. Some candidates to keep an eye on with a week and a half to go in the regular season. Now, final news nugget to get to,
oh,
Steve.
Oh, no, no. As that man said to, now way too quick. Hold on.
Listen to the fact, oh, go ahead.
Listen to the fact that you had to list that out. Get this out of here. Get a band.
Oh, God. Are you also on the bike, on the exercise bike?
Oh, now I'm... Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, fair enough. All right, as we shift to the WNBA side, Steve, the expansion draft is either going to be happening as this episode comes out or had happened by the time this episode comes out, but slated to happen 3:30 Eastern. It's going to be on ESPN, so check that out. If you aren't planning to, go ahead and do so. We've had a trade, Steve. Not just a trade, multiple trades involving the Chicago Sky. They traded the number 17 overall pick in this year's draft, which is the second pick of the second round, to the Portland Fire. Going to trade back four spot in one, which is the sixth pick of the second round. The Fire, with that trade, also agreed not to select anyone from the Sky's unprotected list. And the Sky trading the number 26 overall pick of the draft. That's the 11th pick in the second round. That pick coming via the New York Liberty from a prior trade. That's going to the Toronto Tempo. And in a similar vein, the Tempo also agree not to select anyone from the Sky's unprotected list. So moving back four slots and then also giving up an extra second round pick to keep their unprotected list safe. Steve, how did you feel about this deal when it was announced?
I mean, you know, I've tapped the shenanigans button and people have eventually gotten on board. But I think for me, I think I understand why people are saying, why would the Chicago Sky do that? This makes no sense. It's nonsensical. And whenever people do that, I try and figure out, okay, what's the other perspective, right? If I'm Chicago, and maybe people feel poorly about the Sky based on last year. Maybe they don't believe in the roster based on what happened last year. Maybe this is the Chicago. Like, one, I think in this era, it's going to be very interesting to see how teams evaluate and value the draft in the W, because this has traditionally been a tough spot for second round picks and third round picks to fit and make rosters. The scale is a little bit different for second round picks and third round picks, if I have it correct. And so how does this evolve when it comes to players who are in the draft. What do we evaluate? What do we want? What do we want to add to our team? Mm-hmm. They still have a pick in the second round. You know, I think it's probably, hey, you've made two or three bad decisions. I don't necessarily trust this one, but if I'm Chicago, hey, leave me out of this. I don't have to make any other decisions. I can continue on whatever plan we had, whether it's trying to keep some certain veterans, being able to choose which veterans we want to keep, being able to make a deal, like whatever they had planned, you can't mess with us today. So whatever, take this pick, leave us alone. We'll swap this pick, leave us alone. Now, if you don't trust this guy and what they've done, I get it. Yell at them all you want, but we don't have to make a decision. We can keep our young players. Mm-hmm. We can negotiate with our vets if we'd like. We have a level of control. So I kind of understand to a degree this guy saying, we don't have to worry about anything that's going to happen. Because now if we, you know, you can say they didn't protect X player, which is funny because we'll never know who was protected or unprotected.
Is this true?
We'll never know. I'm sorry, folks. But you can say that. But at the same time, we have control now. You know, I don't have to worry about it. So have a blast. And also put a little pressure on the other teams because we've removed ourselves from the equation. You thought you were safe. Yeah.
Now we slide y'all up off the big board now, buddy.
So that's my devil's advocate bit.
Okay. I think that's fair. And I ended up, because we were co-hosting an appearance of the warm-up when this trade broke. And I was like, okay, I'm going to get to this after we finish this appearance because this is interesting to me. And eventually got my thoughts sorted out together, made a thread on Twitter, et cetera. And I ultimately landed on, if your goal was, as you said, let's protect our own, let's just take ourselves out of this, we're just going to navigate our offseason with as much control as we can. They obviously achieved that goal, and they did so without losing too much. Like, the actual value of the trades themselves, moving back four slots, giving up a late second round pick, in which in the W in general, like as we are guys that cover both the NBA and the W, second round pick draft value is just a lot different on the NBA side than it is on the W side. And just in general, making a roster as a rookie outside of the lottery is a lot more difficult to do on the W side than on the NBA side. So there is an argument that these picks don't really mean all that much. Historically, at the very least, they haven't. And like, if we're only sliding back four spots, we're still going to be in range for some interesting role pieces or some international swings that we can draft and stash. And with this Liberty pick, like, we are making the bet that that's not going to become an earnest W player that we'd be upset about missing out on anyway. And so from a pure value perspective, I don't think this is as big of a deal. Conceptually, though, it felt a tad unnecessary to me looking at the roster and looking at the potential players that could be bit, to where I'm like, I don't know how many players meet the threshold for we have to keep negotiating rights or just rights in general for these players or we're going to feel bad. And a lot of that is based off of, to your point, Steve, what last season was like. Like, for me, I looked at the unrestricted free agent list. I didn't see anyone aside from Ariel Atkins that I felt would be at any real risk of the fire or the tempo being like, yes, we will select them and use the core designation on them. We are willing to give you max money to get you if you are available. I think Ariel Atkins was the only person that risked there. Courtney Vandersloot coming off of the injury, like, I don't think she was going to meet that bar. And then some of the other UFAs, like, I don't think you're going to meet that bar. And so I think you were going to, obviously, you're protecting Angel Reese. You're protecting Camila Cardoso. You have more rookie scale contracts that you could protect as well. So I'm just like, I think between the five, I think you were going to be okay, frankly. I don't know if it was going to be like the Seattle Storm bit from last year where just literally no one from their roster was selected during the expansion draft. But like, you may lose one at most. And based on where you were last year, even the healthy version of yourself last year, I don't know how much that was going to move the needle for you. And so like, I end up tweeting in the thread, it's not that I think the trades were bad. They just felt unnecessary to me because I don't know how much risk you were actually assuming based on who you were likely going to protect. I'd naturally say this as someone that is talking into a podcast mic and not in the front office that actually has intel as to who these teams or front offices would want. But based on from what I can gather from the outside, I don't know if you were really at risk of losing like real needle movers with this after you protect your five players.
I mean, that sounds good. I'll play the other side, but now I'm at no risk. No, yeah. There's no risk for me. I don't have to worry about the people I have draft rights for. I don't have to worry about you taking one of these vets. I like Elizabeth Williams. Maybe I want to bring Elizabeth Williams back. I like Rebecca Allen. Maybe you want to bring Rebecca Allen back. I like Rachel Bannum. Maybe you want to bring Rachel Bannum back. I think you feel bad about how the roster performed last year, but okay. I get to pick and choose which free agents I want to talk to and see if I can bring them back in the fold. You don't have control over that. I get to keep my young players. So you could say, oh, well, you could have left Haley Van Lith or Maddie Westbell, but I don't have to worry about it. You already know who I'm going to keep. I did a lot to bring Ariel Atkins here. I did a lot to get Cordy Vandersloot here. You can argue and yell at me that, hey, they're not moving the needle, but I did this. If I'm in this guy for an office, I can't just hand you that for free on a Friday afternoon. So leave me alone while I figure my life out. Let me disassociate from this expansion draft and you guys figure it out.
Oh, I feel you on that. But I guess that's where I get to like the unrestricted bit. Because to your point, like Rebecca Allen, a veteran I would like to have on a good team. Elizabeth Williams, very much a veteran I would like to have on a good team. The gamble would be, do we think these other teams, not would they like them, because I think they would they like them enough to use the core designation on them? Like, for me, like, I think that answer would be no. But again, I'm on the outside of this. And so that's where, again, I understand the deals, but I'm just like, I don't know if they would have done that. And that's where some of my trepidation came from. But
Guess what? I don't have to think about it anymore.
That's true.
Doesn't matter. It's off the table.
That's true.
Can't leave me alone.
Hashtag leave me alone. Well, we appreciate you, dear listener or watcher, for not leaving us alone and tapping in with us on this episode of the Dunker Spot. So if you haven't already, please subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Plenty of content coming there. You can follow me on socials at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.